From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy New Year. On this New Year's edition of Fresh Air, we're going back into our archives to bring you a couple of our favorite interviews. Musician Les Paul has spent his life playing music and inventing the things he needed to get the sound he wanted. He invented the solid body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multitracking. We'll feature an interview with Les Paul about his life, his music, and his inventions. We also go back to a 1990 interview with John Cleese. Cleese has made a career out of spoofing straight-laced middle-class businessmen. We'll find out how close he came to being one himself. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by the New York quintet New and Used. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush spent New Year's Day in Somalia, pledging continued support for the Somali people and praising the U.S. troops who've come to protect relief supplies. He also had praise for President-elect Bill Clinton and said that Clinton agrees with him that America should not be the world's watchdog. The president had a warning for Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein.
As he made the rounds of American troop sites here, Mr. Bush kept emphasizing the humanitarian nature of this mission. But he also took pains to remind the troops that other missions may lie ahead. And he referred to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein.
He's a madman, and he is brutalizing his people. And the fact that he will come across that 32nd parallel to test us, as they did when we shot the plane down, and as they have done subsequently, makes me think that he doesn't quite get it yet.
Mr. Bush again called on the Iraqi people to throw Saddam out of power, and he promised improved relations if they do. Bill Small with the president in Mogadishu.
Navy officials said yesterday that the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk is now on station in the Persian Gulf where it can support the Allied planes enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq. The Kitty Hawk carries more than 80 warplanes and it joins 12 Allied vessels that are already deployed in the Gulf region. The opposition candidates in Kenya's presidential election said today that they will not accept the victory of President Daniel Arap Moi. Three challengers accused Moi's ruling party of widespread vote fraud and said they'd unite in a peaceful effort to force a new election. International observers noted widespread problems with the election, but have not officially said whether they believe the vote was fair. The latest election results show Moi with more than a 500,000 vote lead over his nearest challenger, with most of the voting districts counted. The leaders of the Czech Republic and Slovakia have each spoken to a special session of their parliaments just hours after the division of Czechoslovakia at midnight. Burton Bolag has more.
The prime ministers of both the Czech Republic and Slovakia tried to allay fears that their separation, consummated only hours earlier, would in any way destabilize Central Europe. Václav Klaus, prime minister of the larger and more prosperous Czech Republic, said his country has an overriding interest in promoting prosperity and political stability in neighboring Slovakia. Both leaders pledged that they want to maintain very close ties between the two republics. For his part, Slovakia's populist leader, Vladimir Mečiar, said Slovakia was now joining the family of nations. He added that he wants to solve the dispute with neighboring Hungary over the Gabčíkovo hydroelectric dam through negotiations. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
There was more snow today in parts of the northwest where yesterday's storm had already closed some highways and downed power lines. This is NPR News. The New Year's Day in Lima, Peru was marked by attacks from the Maoist Shining Path rebels. Police accused the rebels of knocking out power to the capital by dynamiting electric power pylons outside of Lima. They almost also said that the rebels firebombed a marketplace just a block from the presidential palace, injuring at least 10 people. Police said that rebels tried to ram a popular restaurant with a car loaded with explosives, but that the driverless vehicle missed and smashed into a wall. The Shining Path's guerrilla war has claimed at least 25,000 lives and caused $22 billion worth of damage since it began in 1980. The federal government's new definition of AIDS goes into effect today. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
About 50,000 cases of AIDS were reported to the Centers for Disease Control last year. This year, the CDC expects to hear of 90,000 new cases. The big jump is not because more people are suddenly getting ill. It's because the CDC, which sets the official definition of AIDS, has broadened what it calls AIDS. Before now, people had to have HIV in their blood, plus certain infections or cancers known to plague people with AIDS. Effective today, the CDC has added tuberculosis, recurrent pneumonia, advanced cervical cancer, and a low level of immune cells to the list. The expanded definition means that more of the people infected by the virus, especially women, will be counted as having AIDS. That also means that more people will be eligible for already underfunded government treatment programs. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The Dallas Morning News reported today that the FBI is investigating charges that workers in the Perot campaign committed computer piracy. The newspaper said that the charges involved breaking into computer files to check the credit records of Perot volunteers. The FBI would not confirm or deny the investigation. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
It's the Les Paul Show.
Hi. Hello, folks. Let's see, I've got my guitar, I got my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And I got a room just loaded with electronics. We've got some inventions here that make one voice sound like many voices and one guitar like many guitars. And by means of these 6L6s and plugging them into this amplifier, why, we managed to...
Well, why don't you grab a guitar and show the people what you can do?
All right, I got a lot of ideas. Here we go. Now, that's one guitar. Now, if you want two, I just throw a switch.
How about three?
Easy. Now, if you want four, switch.
How about five?
It's a cinch. Now, if you want six, here's a half a dozen easy ones.
Les Paul has spent his life playing guitar, inventing guitars to play, and inventing devices to record himself on. He's invented so much, he's often been called the Thomas Edison of music. For starters, he invented the solid-body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multitracking, inventions that help make rock and roll possible. But Paul himself has stuck to jazz and a more middle-of-the-road pop. In the 1950s, he had several hits with his wife Mary Ford, including How High the Moon, Vaya con Dios, and Bye Bye Blues. To hear the delightful jazz he's playing today at the age of 77, you need to go to the Manhattan Club Fat Tuesdays, where he's performed Monday nights for the past 9 years. Les Paul lives in New Jersey in a home with 4 recording studios. He used one of those studios to talk with us. Our interview was recorded early last year. We're featuring it as part of our Holiday Archive series. We began with the first song in his recent 4-CD retrospective. This is Lover, recorded in 1948 in Les Paul's garage studio. He says it was the first recording that combined all his inventions and recording techniques into one bag of tricks. Les Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. So is that you playing all the parts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was this the first record that you overdubbed on?
Oh, no. No, I started it in 1933. I started in the 20s by punching holes in my mother's piano rolls. But I did it because the rhythm guitar player and bass player would go home and I'd say, darn it, I wanted to have him play Limehouse Blues, and I wanted to try something. And I'd say, well, as long as they're not here, what I'll do is I'll play the bass and I'll play the guitar and I'll do that. But I never recognized that that could be such a tremendous tool.
What was different on this recording of Lover from anything that you'd ever done before?
Well, the sped-up sound, the echo, the playing the bass line, making a guitar sound like a bass. This is the first time in history that anybody had ever done anything like that. And then to speed the guitar up and slow the guitar down, and you get all these different sounds by muffling your strings with your wrist. And these were all new things to be exposed to the world. And of course, I had my problems because so many people weren't ready to accept it.
So on Lover, the high, fast, trebly sounds that we hear, that's a sped-up guitar?
Mm-hmm. Along with the normal guitar, mm-hmm. the whole idea there is to be able to get octaves and to go an octave below and an octave above and to do all the harmony parts and everything, you know. And that was not the very first record I ever made that way, but like I say, it was the first. That was the first one to come out. And that came out about a week after I had an automobile accident where for 2 years I was to be in the hospital just in a basket. everything I had was broken, and I was in bad shape for about 2 years. So I had a lot of time to think, and I unfortunately didn't have that many records in the can, so to speak. What I had are records that were completely done except for the last part, which was the melody. And the reason I left that melody off is I figured that every week that went by, I got better. And if I got better, why, I had newer ideas. And so I'd leave that last part off. And after the automobile accident, I had to do the next recordings in a cast, a body cast. And so with one arm fixed right up even with my face in air, the only thing I could move with my right hand was my thumb. So I put a thumb pick on that, laid the guitar, and I had a rack built to hold the guitar horizontal, and it laid there flat, and I just stood up and played my part, and that's how I made the parts for the next four or five records.
This might be the dictionary definition of obsessive.
Boy, I'm telling you, you learn in a hurry to live with the obstacles, and they can be overcome.
Now, let me get to one of the hits that you had. Let's talk about How High the Moon, which you recorded with Mary Ford, one of your big hits.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of it.
Somewhere there's music, I'll paint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon. There is no moon above, and love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me, it's out of use. Where there's music, ponder how far. Where there's heaven, it's where you are. The darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. Until you will, still my heart, how high the moon.
How would you record Mary's voice to get that echo?
Well, that was something that I spent 2 years trying to find out. I didn't want reverb like an empty room. I didn't want Carnegie Hall. I didn't want that sound. I said to my friend, very dear friend, he and his girlfriend, Mary was my girlfriend, and myself, and a fellow named Wally Jones, we were all sitting in a little tavern at Santa Monica and Western out in Hollywood, and Lloyd was arm wrestling with me, and we had a pitcher of beer and some popcorn, and we're watching the fights on Friday night. And he pulled my arm down really easy, and he says, Les, you're not concentrating. You're usually pretty rough to bring that arm down on. And I said, well, I'm thinking of that echo. And I said, I haven't figured that delay out yet. I haven't figured it out. And he says, well, you still worried about that thing? And I says, yeah, I need it. I need it, and I don't know how to get it. And he says, well, explain it to me again. And so this night, Lloyd, I explained it to Lloyd again. And I says, picture that you're on the Alps. And I say, hello, 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 hello. And I said, I want it to repeat, and I want it to repeat, and I want the delay and the decay to, I want to be able to vary it. And lo and behold, he says to me, you mean like putting the playback head behind the record head? Oh, boy, I threw $10 down on the table, and I said to Wally, pay the bill and bring the girls, you know. And we left him with the $10 bill and the girls, and the beer and the popcorn and the TV were gone. And by the time they got home, you could hear all over the neighborhood, hello, 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 you know? And we'd found the echo, the delay.
You know what I want to know? Why did you want to have echo on her voice?
That's interesting, because I felt as though when you play the note dry, just dead, it just drops like a rock, and it ends right there. And a lot of times you'd like to have that note hang on after you've left it and go to the next note. And it's very similar to ambience in a room, the sound of a room where it's enhanced by bare walls. If I happen to be talking to you and I happen to be in a very empty room, you could recognize that riding in your car, listening at home. You say, well, I can tell that these people are talking in a very empty room. Or you can say they're talking in a phone booth. It's so small. Or it's a very large hall. So you have command over what you wish to do. And in this case, I didn't want that note to say, hey, and just go on like Carnegie Hall. I wanted to go, hey, hey. See? And now if you want, you put a little tail on it. You go, hey, 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 hey. You know? And it gives you such command of so many things, the toys to work with. Today, they're not, I call them toys because the kids, they have all these little boxes that you can go in and buy in the store. When I was a kid and I visualized this thing, the reason I had to invent it is because you couldn't buy it in a store. So if I wanted it, I had to make one.
You know, if I didn't know that you were telling me the truth, I would think that you were really crazy and exaggerated a lot.
No.
You've done so many remarkable things in one life.
Yeah. Yeah, that I have. I wonder why that is. I woke up today thinking about it because in an interview they asked me what I wanted on my tombstone. I thought about it a minute, and I said, I guess I'd put on there, why me?
But do you feel like you were chosen?
I don't know. I just say, I just happened to be around at that time, and there wasn't an electric guitar, so I built one, and there wasn't an echo, so I made one. There wasn't a multi-track machine, so I built one. There wasn't sound on sound, so I made one. And it went on and on and on and continues today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Les Paul, and he's actually talking to us from one of the studios in his home in New Jersey. And there's a new 4-set CD box that's just been released called Les Paul, The Legend and the Legacy. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Les Paul is joining us from one of the studios in his home. I saw you about a year ago at Fat Tuesdays, a club in New York where you play every Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday, and you sounded terrific.
Thank you.
I understand that you have arthritis of the fingers. How do you play?
Well, after my heart surgery in 1980, they just said, well, you're going to have to do something else because you can't play. Your hands are gone. And I only had a couple of fingers on each hand then. Now I have no fingers in the right hand move. They're fixed. And so there's no movement except at the knuckles. And in the left hand, I only have two fingers, really one and a half, because the first finger is half frozen and painful. What do I do? I just have figured out that if I could do that, whatever I did then, I just figure out how to do that with two fingers. And so what I have done is, I says, well, what I used to do with two hands and all my fingers, I'm sure it can be done. And lo and behold, it can be.
So you've really taken the same approach to your body as you've taken to designing instruments and engineering equipment.
Oh, are you're great. You're great, Terry. You're great. The key to that is that the same will, the same power that you have to destroy yourself, you can use to make yourself well. If you have arthritis, you just have to have a iron jaw, and you got to go in there and not use any cop out that, well, I can't play anymore because of the arthritis. You just say, there's a way. And I think that determination, I think that, and of course, you have to have a lot of luck, and you have to have the right genes and all that jazz to go with it. But I think the bottom line is that if you want to hard enough, you can do it.
What's your threshold for pain? How good are you with pain?
Oh, boy, I tolerate pain. It's unbelievable what you can tolerate if you have that, again, if you have that attitude about it. First of all, you got to think up and not down. And first of all, you don't think of work as a dirty word. You think of that as something that is a privilege. When I was in the hospital and the doctor called me in the office and he says, promise me you'll work hard. And I says, Doc, I thought that's what put me in here. And he says, no, Les. He says, nobody died of overwork. Promise me that you'll work hard. So I went upstairs and they wheeled me upstairs and I asked the nurse for a piece of paper and I drew a line down the center of it. And I put plus on one side, minus on the other. This one, that one, all the great things that we've done in my lifetime. And when it came to the end, I looked at the list and it was overwhelming that the best time I had in my life was playing in a little nightclub. Now, I'd given up the guitar in 1965 and says, let the young kids have it. I've made my money. I'm going to get out and invent and go manage and record and go another direction, but forget the guitar. This piece of paper in 1980 said to me I should go back and play the guitar, and where I was happiest is in a little club, an intimate nightclub. So when I got well, I marched into New York, and I looked at all the clubs, and finally I find this club. And I said, this is my club. So I go to the manager, and he's 6'4". He's a big, tall guy, Scott. And I said, sir, I'd like to talk to you. My name is Les Paul. He says, Les who? I says, Les Paul.
No.
Yeah. Les Paul. And he says, name sounds familiar. I says, yeah, I play the guitar, and I'd like to come in and play in your club. And he says, well, what do you do? What kind of music you play? And I says, you know, darn if I know. I've never been able to put a handle on that one. And he says, well, what have you got? And I says, well, I got a trio, and I'd like to come in here. And he says, well, I don't think we're interested. And I says, not only that, I'd like to be in on a Monday night. He says, we're not even open on Mondays. And he says, no. And I says, but I'm willing to work for nothing. He says, we're interested.
Right.
And so the bottom line was is that I made a deal with the boss, and he says, I'll put you in for 2 weeks, and I'll take the door and part of the liquor and whatever. Went in there for 2 weeks, and the audience reaction was tremendous, and it was loaded, and you couldn't get in, and it was just great.
Are you still inventing, or are you still in the process of creating things?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What are you working on?
We're working on a bass, Les Paul bass, that will be at the NAMM show next week. We're working on all kinds of things. I've invented a thing for piano. I got another thing for high blood pressure. I got all kinds of things.
Something for high blood pressure?
Mm-hmm.
You getting into the medical field now?
Well, it's just that...
you need it.
Not that I need it. I saw that that there was room for it in the medical world. There's a lot of things that you recognize if you're lying in bed and you see a guy do something that's the hard way. And you say, you know, how come you're doing it that way? Well, the same thing applies to... it goes all the way back to... Terry, if I can really take you way back, it's the first time that my mother in her home had a radio, a Victrola, okay? That's the gramophone, that's the phonograph, okay? And a player piano. And I'm sitting there with all these things. And I looked at it and I says, you know, there's something interesting here. This piano, I can punch a hole in it wherever I wish. And that note will come out. And I can slow it down and speed up, and it doesn't change pitch. Okay? It just gets slower or faster. If I put my hand on a phonograph record and I slow it down, the pitch changes. Why? And that's the key to the whole thing, that curiosity of that you just asked that question, why? And you got your life cut out for you.
Well, Les Paul, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Les Paul spoke to us from one of the four recording studios in his New Jersey home. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. The 4-CD box set, Les Paul, The Legacy and the Legend, is on Capitol Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When we spoke to John Cleese in 1990, he was more interested in talking about his corporate training videos than in talking about his acting. Coming up, we find out why. It's part of our special New Year show from the Fresh Air Archives. We also talked to Cleese about how he spent his career making fun of his own middle-class upbringing. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by New and Used, a quintet from New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. U.S. President George Bush jumped into a foxhole today while visiting U.S. troops in Somalia. Mr. Bush traveled by helicopter and armored personnel carrier to see the troops. He also visited with a number of Somali residents. In the town of Baidoa, he spent half an hour at an orphanage that houses more than 700 children. He called the multinational effort to bring relief supplies to Somalia a wonderful mission of mercy. During his second day in the East African nation, the president was asked a number of times how long the troops would have to stay there. He said he did not know the answer, but that the U.S. commitment to provide troops is not an open-ended one. President Bush is now spending his second evening on board the aircraft carrier Tripoli before he heads to Russia for a summit with that country's president. And officials in France announced today that President Bush will stop in Paris to meet President François Mitterrand on Sunday following Bush's summit meeting in Moscow. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The spokesman for President Mitterrand said President Bush will arrive in Paris Sunday afternoon and that the two men will hold talks and a working dinner at the Élysée Palace. This is expected to be the last meeting between the two leaders before George Bush leaves office January 20th. The two men have had a close working relationship. They joined forces during the Gulf War, and now, for a second time, French forces are under U.S. command, this time in Somalia. The two presidents are expected to discuss the situation in Somalia and the war in Bosnia. Mitterrand has called for military action there if peace talks among the warring factions do not produce any results. France has 4,000 troops in Bosnia, which could be targeted if the United Nations resorts to military force. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
According to the latest official election results in Kenya, longtime ruler Daniel Arap Moi has apparently won that nation's first multi-party elections. It's the first time he's ever been directly elected. But opposition leaders vowed today to prevent Moi from continuing in office, NPR's Daniel Swerdling reports.
Leaders of Kenya's three major opposition parties issued a joint statement today, charging that Moi and his colleagues committed massive election fraud and stole the elections. Although dozens of opposition candidates were elected to parliament, party leaders said they would all boycott any Moi government. Opposition leaders insisted they want Kenyans to remain peaceful, but they would not explain how they expect to kick Moi out of office without widespread civil disobedience or violence. Many Kenyan and international poll watchers disagreed with Moi's opponents. U.S. Ambassador Smith Hempstone, who helped pressure Moi to hold multi-party elections, said today that the balloting was seriously flawed, but good enough that Kenyans should accept the results. I'm Daniel Swerdling in Nairobi.
Regulations that required customs checks inside the borders of the European community ended with the new year. This now means that any European citizen with an EC passport can now travel freely in any EC country. This is NPR from Washington. President Bush and Russian President Boris Yeltsin opened their final summit in Moscow on Saturday to sign the latest arms control agreement between the two nations. The pact cuts U.S. and Russian long-range nuclear arsenals by two-thirds over the next 10 years. On Friday, President Bush called the treaty the most historic arms control agreement ever made. U.S. and Russian negotiators finished the agreement Tuesday in Geneva. The FBI is reportedly investigating charges that people working for Ross Perot illegally retrieved the credit reports of some campaign workers. The investigation was reported today by the Dallas Morning News. The FBI will not officially confirm or deny that it's looking into the Perot campaign. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Ross Perot, the former independent presidential candidate, has acknowledged before that he hired private investigators to check into campaign workers accused of misusing campaign money. He has insisted that the investigations were legal. But the Dallas Morning News reports that some credit records were obtained using stolen computer codes. The paper quotes representatives of one of the country's top three credit reporting companies, Equifax, as saying that at least 17 credit files of former Perot campaign workers may have been retrieved illegally last spring. Six petition drive coordinators in three states also told the paper that their credit histories had been pulled without their knowledge. Some reports were accessed using the security code of a New Jersey-based leasing company. Company representatives say they never requested the information on the Perot volunteers. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Leaders of Bosnia's three warring factions headed to Geneva today for weekend talks aimed at ending the fighting in their country. These are the first face-to-face talks for the leaders, but they're widely considered to be the last chance to avoid Western military intervention in the area. Pressure continues to build for the United Nations to use military force to ensure its no-fly zone against Bosnian Serb aircraft. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews from our archives for this New Year's Day, and we've chosen one we hope will help you laugh off any lingering hangover. This is a 1990 interview with John Cleese, founding member of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus, star of the British TV comedy series Fawlty Towers, and star of the 1988 comedy A Fish Called Wanda. Lately, his performances have been in TV commercials. It wasn't comedy that brought the former minister of Silly Walks to Philadelphia in 1990. John Cleese came to the city to participate in a family therapy conference. He led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner. The two collaborated on the 1983 book, Families and How to Survive Them. You'll actually hear Skinner laughing in the background during our interview. Cleese's comic characterizations have skewered the businessman mentality. His father was an insurance salesman. I wanted to know if Cleese developed some of his characters by watching his father.
I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie Fine sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off. And they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life, too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they glipose and overcall at the Murga chooses. Their stavilla across the bottom, part of Isaac cruise together in mid-slever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slow perfection. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yeah, the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958. And I've never forgotten it. They got me into the footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, you know, I always like very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually like one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that?
Oh yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten it. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
You say in the book Families and How to Survive Them that most problems that we have as adults are grounded in our family experience, our early family experience. Let me ask you, John Cleese, about your early family experience. Now, your parents were in your 40s when they had you.
That's right. Dad was 46 and my mother was 40.
And your father was 46.
My father, yeah. Is that what I said?
You said you were 46.
That's interesting. I was 46, my second daughter was born.
Did you want to analyze what this means?
Many a true word spoken in jest, yes.
Yeah, I was born a little bit with pipe and slippers. I've always been rather middle-aged. That's very funny. Now, I was 46 when my second daughter was born, and I think that that was kind of strange. Because it's late for someone to have a child.
So were you the kid whose parents were older than all the other parents?
Absolutely, and had been married for 13 years before I arrived. And everybody was astounded when they suddenly announced they were going to have a child because they'd been sort of marked down as not going to have children. And I think that the fact that they were old and therefore probably a bit more cautious and a bit more protective affected me. I still wince if anybody turns the television on too loudly in my house because my mother was always saying that, you know, it's too noisy, it'll disturb the neighbours. I've got a very, very strong sort of lower middle class respectability streak in me, which I hate.
John Cleese is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1990 interview from our archives with John Cleese. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tic, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life mm-hmm. or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting. Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. And if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Timbrook Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself is quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies mm-hmm. in England, but that's a minority thing. It's the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills.
But still, you have to do films that have to be approved of by top executives in large corporations, right?
No, because we make them with our own money. I mean, if somebody like, for example, Volvo came to uh-huh. us to make a couple of commission films 10 years ago, I remember them because I was in them, then, of course, we very much listen to what sort of film they want to make and understand what the information or attitude that they want to put across. But that's sort of 5% of our work. 95% of it is making films with our own money. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn, if they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious, if they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment, and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise, and he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise? Oh, well, a sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh metallic sound.
What, steady or pulsating or measured or intermittent or seasonal or cyclical or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm wondering if you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, we founded the company in 1972, and I'm proud to say that it's now the biggest company of its kind in the world outside the States. We've been making that claim for 10 years, and I'm sure it's right because nobody's ever contested it. And I find that making the films that we do, like, for example, the recent one I made, which was on really showing a manager how to coach his subordinates, is not only very interesting, but I actually believe it's enormously worthwhile. I think it helps to move business and therefore society in slightly healthier directions and ways of operating, which very much chime in with the sort of ideas of what is mental health that Robin and I discuss all the time, which incidentally our second book's all about.
I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But so before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and make the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do, basically, because you were trying to build your career.
I'd like to get back to acting for a moment, John Cleese.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I was writing something that I'm going to say again when we address the conference on Friday about why I don't like being referred to as an actor.
Oh, because you write the stuff, as I imagine, part of it.
Yes, but it's something else. It's something deeper than that. I've got a resistance to it. I think it's because I know actors well, and I know they spend all their time trying to impress people, and I don't like to admit there's a bit of me that does that just as much as any other actor. You know, there's a bit of me that wishes it wasn't like that. I didn't have to impress other people so much. It's funny. It's one of the descriptions of me that always gets my hackles up. It's insane, isn't it?
John Cleese in an interview recorded in 1990.
Grabbing up your hats, coats, boots, and everything. Leave your worries on the doorstep, cause we're gone by and by. Just direct your feet. You'll look neat on the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear the bitter and the batter of the raindrops trickling down your fire escape ladder?
I used to walk in the shade with my blues on parade. Well, I'm not afraid, 'cause my rovers, they're over, passed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller with gold dust at my feet on the sunny, yes, on the sunny, well, on the sunny side of the street.
This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Noah Adams from All Things Considered in Washington with a word about our program coming up. Weather is in the news tonight. New Year's Eve storm stopping traffic and trains. We'll have a report from the Pacific Northwest. And I'll talk with some folks stranded along the Amtrak line in the town of Havre, Montana. They're waiting comfortably there despite the fact that it's 29 degrees below zero. Also, Suni Collett reports from Somalia. Daniel Zwerdling from Nairobi on the Kenyan elections. Tom Jelton from Bratislava in the brand new Czech Republic. And Bob Garfield reports on the television business of infomercials. That's coming up later on NPR's All Things Considered.
An old adage says that jazz swings to the right during Republican administrations and gets more progressive under Democrats. The revolutionary music of bebop sprang up under Roosevelt and Truman. The 60s avant-garde flourished under Lyndon Johnson's watch. And button-down Wynton Marsalis came along around the same time Reagan was sworn in. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's looking forward to the Clinton years if it means we'll be hearing more bands like the New York Quintet, new and used.
Like the Art Ensemble of Chicago, New and Used is an exception to the rule that a jazz band has to be named for its leader to be any good. In fact, this quintet has five leaders, all of whom write for the band. The balance of power keeps shifting around, from gig to gig, from tune to tune, and within an individual piece. That's on New and Used's debut album, Souvenir, on the label Knitting Factory Works. One reason this band pulls in a lot of different directions is the diverse background of its members. Violinist Mark Feldman, a gifted improviser and interpreter of written music, co-leads the string trio Arcado. Diggs fusion violinist Zbigniew Seifert has been used as a featured soloist by composer Anthony Davis and spent years on the road with Loretta Lynn. Alto and baritone saxophonist Andy Laster has recorded three albums under his own name and has toured with Lyle Lovett. Dave Douglas, who's played hard bop with Horace Silver and klezmer music with Don Byron, has over the last couple of years developed into an exceptional trumpeter. He plays wide leaping lines with a bell-like tone that sounds more like a cornet than a trumpet. Imagine an avant-garde Bix Beiderbecke or Ruby Braff. We'll be right back. New and Used is full of good players, but so are some pretty dull bands. The difference here is the quality of the writing, which reflects the musicians' varied experience, but doesn't sound patched together. On the downtown New York scene in the 80s, composition was often about disruptive jump cuts, the style John Zorn made famous. In the 90s, it's more about getting diverse ideas or textures to flow naturally from one to another. One major asset in doing that is a superior rhythm section. Bassist Kermit Driscoll from guitarist Bill Frisell's band and drummer Tom Rainey, who has a great ear for detail and rarely plays anything the same way twice. This is from Mark Feldman's compulsive gambling epic, Trifecta. That kind of complex, integrated writing is becoming common in New York and elsewhere these days. Not that you'd know it from reading the jazz magazines or from all those underripe bebop revival records the major labels keep pushing. Well, the Democrats are back now, so maybe that'll change. Jazz is as due for overhaul as the executive branch was, and for some of the same reasons. A failure to come to grips with a radically changed world, intolerance for the unconventional, and a vision of art with no place for daring, risk, or raunchiness. You know something's wrong in a country when a presidential candidate gets sneered at for playing the saxophone. On the other hand, the saxophone player got elected.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator living in New York City. He reviewed Souvenir by New and Used on the Knitting Factory label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy new year.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, guns. We talk with Eric Larson, who is researching a book on the gun trade in America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.